Welcome to the Advisor Advocates Podcast. My name is Garrett Lill. I'm a certified financial planner and former advisor. And I started Advisor Advocates in this podcast to share with other advisors some of the experience that I like to say I accidentally accumulated over the course of my 13-year career, especially around the areas of the industry involving transitions from one firm to the other, advisor recruiting, M&A deals, things of that nature. Interesting thing for advisors that I've experienced in my career is that advisors are often on an island. We don't really know what's out there. We don't know what's going on outside the walls of our firm and outside the confines of our own practices. Especially when I was working in the recruiting industry and talking with advisors, there were just so many advisors who didn't know what they didn't know. So the purpose of this podcast and Advisor Advocates is to help bridge that information gap, to help advisors understand a little bit more about what the landscape looks like out there, what options are available to you, and sort of share some of the insights that I've ran into and hopefully answer some of the most common questions that advisors have. On this show, we're going to dive into the valuation of a practice, what is going to determine a fair valuation for a financial advisor's practice to help both sides better understand what a fair price is and what variables are going to play into that decision. So this show is really going to be broken down in sort of two parts. There's the valuation of the firm itself, but then a very, very closely related second part is going to surround the deal structure and how the cash flow of the deal looks like. And I say they're very closely related because the deal structure itself is going to play a pretty big factor in which on what valuation you get. And I'll explain that, and I think it'll be pretty intuitive as we go a little bit further along here. Each of these points, they're going to build on each other. For you to get the most out of this, I think it's important for you to stick around and listen to the end because I think the last point that I make is actually probably going to be more important than the first point that I'm going to make, but you can't just skip to the end and feel like you're really going to get the full value of it either, because each of these is going to be related to the previous point and also sort of build in a compounding way. So the first point that I'm going to make is completely irrelevant if you don't consider the fourth and fifth points as we move along here. So if this is something that you're serious about learning more about, and invest the time to listen to the full show and see sort of how these things play off of each other, and hopefully it'll be a productive use of your time. The first component that is the most basic and most important to determine the value of your firm is definitely going to be the revenue profile. And that's pretty simple, pretty intuitive, but it is kind of broken down into two parts. There is the size of the firm that's going to make up the profile in terms of just how much revenue do you have. Larger firms, put very simply, are going to get higher multiples than smaller firms. Now, if somebody out there has heard otherwise or has seen a deal where a $200 million firm got a higher multiple on revenue than a $400 million firm, I'm not saying that that's not possible by any means. In fact, as we go further along, that'll kind of illustrate my point that a lot of other factors are going to play into this equation more than just the size itself. But as a general rule, all things being equal, most of the time you are going to see larger firms catch higher multiples, either in terms of EBITDA for larger firms or multiples of revenue for the smaller firms. I think as a starting point to the conversation, I like to use the $100 million firm as a nice little benchmark. I think 3x revenue is a very nice, comfortable starting point for $100 million firms. Certainly 3.25 is possible. There are, I'm sure, some deals that are less than that. The deals come in all shapes and sizes, but I think if you're a $100 million firm in terms of assets under management, $1 million or so of revenue, 3x revenue, maybe 3.25 is a nice, comfortable starting point where sellers aren't going to run away and buyers are going to be interested in at least starting a conversation. Doesn't mean the deal is going to get done there, but I think that's a nice starting point. As you move down the spectrum, you know, a $50 to $75 million firm, that may be 2.75 to 3. If you're a $10 to $50 million firm, we might be talking 2.5 to 2.75. If you're a $250 billion firm going the other direction, maybe you're at 3.25, maybe 3.5. If you're managing $500 million of assets, maybe you're at 3.5 to 4. And then when you're north of $1 billion, typically we're starting to get away from multiplying at times revenue. We're starting to get to our valuation based on a multiple of EBITDA instead of revenue. So the larger you get, the bigger multiple you're going to get. But another really important component of this that is very, very often overlooked, especially by advisors, is that your revenue breakdown is probably going to be more important than just the overall scale and size of your revenue and of your practice, because all revenue streams are definitely not going to be created equally and valued equally. Again, if you're selling a $100 million practice, to get that 3 or 3.25 times revenue number that we're talking about, that's really talking just about the advisory AUM fees, asset-based management fees, where a client's paying 1% or 1.25% of their account value. As you start to look into the other mixes or other types of revenue that could be coming into a practice, they are not going to get that high of a multiple typically, because the industry loves AUM fees for two, I think, key reasons. I'm sure there's more than just these two, but I think the two most important ones are, frankly, the regulators like the fiduciary standard. They like us managing practices where the advisors are paid to be a fiduciary, not paid to sell products. I don't care if you agree with that or not. The market's spoken pretty loud on that particular fact, and the regulators like advisory more than they like brokerage. Second, there is the built-in tailwind of market growth on advisory fees. So as the market grows, the advisor or the firm that's acquiring the practice in this case is going to get a built-in pay raise to not do any more additional work, really. You're not doing any extra work to manage a $2 million account than you did a $1 million account. You're just making more money. So that built-in tailwind, plus the fact that the regulators like it more, definitely puts the highest premium on AUM-based fees. You also have planning fees. And this is a more popular emerging phenomenon over the last decade or so, where advisors are starting to negotiate fixed fees, whether that be pay per hour or pay per year or pay per month, but they're flat fees that are especially popular among your wealthier clients who don't like the fact that they're paying more for the same service, but just because they have more money with you. So planning fees are starting to become a more popular part of practices. And it's also a pretty difficult one to value in terms of, what kind of a multiple would you get on planning fee revenue, because, we haven't seen a lot of practices around long enough to sell those practices and see what the average multiples are. I would say, from working with firms that specialize in this and are looking to potentially sell, they're nowhere near as popular as traditional firms in terms of desirability for an acquirer to go out and buy those fixed fees, because they lack the inherent scalability that comes with that constant pay increase over time. And if you want to see a pay increase from an individual client, you're going to have to go to that client and negotiate that, and sort of ask, it's kind of like asking your boss for a pay raise to account for inflation, where, asset-based fees automatically go up, but you don't get that with planning fees. Now, as we move down the rest of the scale here, I would say that we're slowly starting to move down from a 3x multiple down to a 2.5 to a 2, all the way down to a 1 and even a 0 in some cases here. But I think the next most valuable form of revenue tends to be mutual fund trails, because those are easily converted to advisory in most cases. If you have legacy A-share funds, those are easy for the acquirer to convert to an institutional share class, and then they can segment those advisory accounts separately, or those funds into a separate account where they can, it may still be at a 0.25% management fee instead of a 1% management fee. It also may eventually be converted to a full managed account where it's back up to the 1%. So those funds are pretty easily transferred or converted into an advisory account. So for that reason, it's not uncommon to see fund trails still factored in at that 2.5, maybe 3 times revenue, maybe even matching the higher end of 3.25, maybe in some cases. But that's going to depend on how confident the acquiring firm is. Well, it's going to depend on a couple of things. How big of a percentage of your revenue are those fund trails compared to advisory? And then also, how easily are they going to be to convert? Fixed insurance trails, if you're doing any fixed insurance business that's paying you a back-end fee, and I'm talking really just like renewals on term policies and things like that. I'm not talking about index annuities that might be coming up for a renewal or a potential 1035 anytime soon. I'm talking about pure month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter trails from legacy products that were sold. You may get a 2x revenue multiple on that revenue. Variable annuity trails are going to see a little bit of a dip in that in most cases, maybe in the 1.5 to 2.5 times revenue range, because there are some insurance providers that are offering RIA-friendly variable annuities contracts. So there might be the capability for the acquirer to convert that to an advisory revenue at some point. But there are also some situations where I've seen that be completely excluded altogether and not even factored in. So I would say, as a median, maybe 1.5, 2 times revenue on that variable annuities trail revenue. But in some cases, again, it may not be factored in at all. And then you've got your, what I believe to be the least valuable source of revenue, which is going to be your transactional business. This is the, you know, the $5,000 you made from selling a $100,000 variable annuity last year, or the $10,000 worth of commission you earned from a stock account or from stock trades. That revenue may be factored in, again, on the high end, maybe 1.5 times. It may be completely eliminated altogether from the calculation. You know, if you wrote a life insurance policy last year that you got $500,000 on, that's already been earned. The acquirer is getting nothing for that. That's not going to be factored in whatsoever. But if you have a bond client who's got $1 million in a bond account, and you've got a nice ladder of bonds that are constantly renewing and that's steady, you may get 1.5 times for that. But it is typically going to be the least valuable of all. So when you're looking at the overall revenue profile, you know, again, with back to the simple example to start with, $100 million, 100% advisory, you might be at 3x. But if that $100 million of total AUM is broken down and you've got, you know, $600,000 advisory fees and $200,000 in VA trails and $100,000 in mutual fund trails and $100,000 of stock transactions, I would kind of take that framework, and you may have to do a little bit of math to, you know, multiply each category of revenue times the corresponding multiple, add all those together, and then that's, you know, is going to bring you a little bit closer to a blended average of what you might want to expect. And then if that blended average comes out to 2.75, again, adjust that for the size of your practice. If you have, you know, a breakdown of where the multiple comes out to be 2.75 and you're a $25 million firm, you're probably not adjusting that off of the 3x anymore. You're probably adjusting it off the 2.5 starting point. So maybe you're at 2.25. If you got the same practice and it's $500 million of assets under management, if the revenue multiple started at 4, with that revenue mix, you might be at 3.5. Much more important than the revenue mix, however, is going to be the relationships of your practice and how strong of a relationship do you have with your clients, and also who are those clients? Where are they in life, and what are their future business prospects for your practice? A nice starting point, again, is probably the median to get that 3x multiple. The 3.25 starting point is going to be, you know, around 55 years of age for the majority of your clients, or for your median household age. That's also going to be adjusted downward a little bit if your clients are starting retirement right now and starting to take distributions from their accounts. And if you're happen to be working with a lot of young professionals who have $1 million average account size and they're all in their late 30s, early 40s, you might be able to increase that multiple a little bit. Also, the family tree of your clients. You know, if your clients are all set to inherit another $100 million in the next 5 or 10 years, that's certainly going to be factored in. And we can kind of talk about that a little bit later on. But also, how sticky are your clients? You know, what's your service model look like? How often do you talk to your top clients? How confident are you in their ability or their willingness really to stick with you through the transition or to take the recommendation to stay with this firm? What is that going to look like? How often do your clients refer business to you? You know, if you've got a service model and a loyalty where clients have been trained and conditioned to constantly refer other clients to you, then that's certainly going to increase the growth prospects of your practice as well. So again, I say that these things build on each other because you could be at a starting point where maybe your revenue mix isn't exactly ideal. If you have a young client base who loves working with you and loves the firm that you're going to join or who is going to be taking over the relationship, your book is set to double in value over the next decade just from inheritances alone, then yeah, I think that you may see that multiple end up getting back to a 3.5 or maybe even 4x in some practices, despite the fact that the revenue mix isn't exactly ideal. There is an extra category that I would call potential revenue, and that's going to be valued at, you know, anywhere from 0 to maybe 2.5 times future potential revenue, depending on how far it is out into the future and also how sticky and loyal those clients are. I was speaking with a firm not too long ago where they've written a lot of life insurance policies, and they have a lot of aging clients with life insurance policies that have really big face values, and they have great relationships with the beneficiaries, and they know that their AUM is going to double in the next 5 to 10 years based on that alone. You're not necessarily going to get, you know, a 3x multiple on future potential revenue 10 years down the road, but there is going to be an adjustment factor there where, yeah, that may take the overall multiple from 3x to 3.5 just because the firm can see that future growth potential kind of built into it. Now, I think the next layer of that cake, and again, I think this is far more important than the relationships of your practice and much more important than the revenue mix of your practice, is going to be how well does your business model fit within the overall ecosystem of the acquiring firm. If there are a lot of overlaps in philosophy and a lot of overlaps in key strengths and core competencies of both organizations and both practices, and you're going to be able to just plug what your practice is directly into what they're doing without really feeling like that from the client's perspective, there's been any hiccups at all, that's going to make your practice far more valuable than if the acquirer is going to have to come in and kind of recondition and retrain all of your clients to now adopt their philosophies and to see their view of financial planning and investments the same way that that they do. And if the acquiring firm doesn't feel like there's a cultural fit or doesn't feel like their way of doing business is really going to necessarily jive with the way you've traditionally done business, that's going to dilute the value a great deal. Whereas if there is a wonderful overarching common ground there, then they're going to be willing to pay a little bit more of a premium for that. And also look at the resulting partnership, especially if you're sticking around, and we'll get into this a little bit more. If you're going to be a part of the new organization and a part of their team, then there's also the opportunity there where you may be filling in some gaps that they currently have. And it could be a true, you know, 2 + 2 = 5 scenario where the new larger organization with now the additional skill set and talent that you're bringing in is going to be a rising tide that lifts all the ships. And in those cases, you're really going to get a bigger premium. In the larger deals especially, you're going to have things like cost savings and multiplier effects that are going to factor in where, you know, again, the key strengths of two large organizations coming together, you're able to eliminate costs but increase the overall talent pool. That's definitely going to be more applicable in the larger, you know, multi-billion dollar AUM deals where you're really looking more at EBITDA and starting to get into some of those line items on the income statement. But the overall, how much leverage are you going to have from combining these practices is going to play a big role in how big of a multiple the acquirer is willing to pay. So for that reason, for advisors that are shopping, I highly encourage that to be one of your most important things, is to find some, you know, make sure you're finding a firm that is going to be at least plug and play for your existing business, and then hopefully be able to find a firm that you can plug into or plug these clients into that is going to be able to complement what they're already doing in a way that will improve, you know, the rest of their overall business model. And then the last component of this, and again, as these things just continue to build on each other, the risk proportioning or the deal structure, including the long-term plans of the advisor who is walking away from the business, is going to probably play a bigger role in what type of a deal you're going to get as the advisor selling or what the overall value of a practice is going to be than maybe all of the other three combined. There is a certain amount of risk involved in any financial transaction, and there's going to be a dividing up of that risk. So if you are an advisor who's looking to get as much cash up front as possible, you're asking the firm to bear, the acquiring firm, to bear the majority of that financial risk, and they're going to discount the premium that they're willing to pay you to account for that risk that, hey, the market may go down and their revenue may not stay the same. Some of those clients may leave. You could end up being disingenuous in your intentions and going across the street and stealing some of those clients back. The more of that risk you're asking the other firm to bear, the less they're going to be willing to pay for it. On the other hand, if you're willing to defer a large part of your compensation and tie it to the revenue that the practice generates over a longer period of time, you may see a much higher premium because now you're taking on more of that risk of the deal not working out. Where this all really comes together and maybe is the most important factor that really drives all of these things together is going to be how the advisor plays into the future plans of the acquiring firm's practice and specifically with those client relationships. Because if you're just simply folding into a large organization and joining them and you're going to be paid a traditional advisor payout based on the revenue of that practice, it can end up being sort of a win-win all the way around because the advisor has residual income. They're not necessarily retiring. They're just going to work for the acquirer. And that job is going to be tied to the success and growth of that practice. So there's alignment there. And because there's less friction and less concern of client turnover through this transaction, the overall, you know, weighted average outcome, I guess, of the transaction goes up for everybody. And now both parties have a vested interest in sort of splitting up that risk a little bit because your interests are aligned. So to me, that is the most valuable way both parties can kind of maximize the value of a deal is to make sure that your interests are aligned in terms of how you see the business and how you want to grow the business and then structure the deal accordingly, where maybe the advisor does get half of the cash up front and you're sort of splitting up that financial risk a little bit. But now there's a higher revenue share for a longer period of time to help the firm that's acquiring the practice spread out the financial hit of the purchase and also allow the advisor to participate in some of the growth on that practice. And if the advisor is also continuing to stick around and work as a part of that ecosystem for a while, then the advisor themselves is also going to be even further incentivized to continue to grow the book as an employee of the acquirer. So that's probably the ultimate magnifier in terms of multiples. I mean, you can see deals structured where maybe the acquiring advisor pays 2x upfront in cash and then a 40 basis point trail for the next 5 years tied to revenue, and then another 30 basis points as an advisor payout for that advisor for as long as they want to stay and stick around and work there. And now you do the quick math on that. If the advisor works there for 5 years at a 30% payout, that's 1.5 times the original starting point of revenue. The back-end revenue component of the deal itself is another 2 times the revenue. So you stack all those on top of each other, and if you get a market lift or some of those client accounts continue to grow and you continue to thrive in that combined ecosystem, then you can see a rising tide that lifts all boats, and the advisor may get 6 or 7 times the original revenue from year one, and the firm is more than happy to pay that because they've acquired a book that is continuing to grow and thrive as well. I do highly encourage advisors to look for firms that they believe they can fit into in that type of an environment. And it really is a common thing that I'm starting to see more and more of now, where a lot of advisors who are selling their practices aren't 65, 70, 80 years old looking for the payday so that they can retire. A lot of advisors are just getting to a point in their career where maybe they want to slow down and they want to find someone that they can kind of tuck in under and operate with to do the heavy lifting and help the mothership, so to speak, be responsible for coming up with the ideas to grow the practice, but in a way that the advisor can sort of enjoy that tailwind of growth. I'm also seeing even younger advisors than that in their mid-40s that are looking around at the environment and seeing how fast some of these other firms are growing, and they want to grow and they want to keep up. And what they can quickly learn is that sometimes selling into the right practice and converting the equity you've built in your own practice into equity in a larger firm that's outgrowing you, or even converting it for cash and continuing to just tuck your practice in somewhere where it can grow faster. There are some advisors out there that are starting to realize the value in that. And in my opinion, from seeing a lot of these deals, the best multiples do come from that type of a system. Because if you just want cash on day one, yeah, you can negotiate a deal at 3 times and maybe you can get a good chunk of that in cash. And that's really all there's going to be. But now the selling advisor has to retire and start drawing from their own assets or find another job, where if you sort of throw all these things into the blender and kind of come up with something a little bit more in the middle of all these extremes, where there's some cash up front to the advisor, some long-term payout to stick around and service the book, and then some long-term revenue share to incentivize the advisor to at least participate in trying to help grow that book, you can end up seeing a large compounding effect. Now, my final point is too important of a point to ignore entirely, and it's a simple enough point that it shouldn't take very long. But by far, the one factor that outweighs all of the other factors is going to be the reputability of the other partner or the counterparty in the deal. You can negotiate the best deal in the world. If the person on the other side of that transaction is not someone that you can trust or not someone who has the utmost integrity or the best reputation in the industry, and they end up not paying you what they promised you, or from the firm side, you bring in an advisor who turns around and stabs you in the back, then it completely unwinds the entire deal that you negotiated. So the most important factor is always going to be finding that right fit with that right person that you trust. And I do think for that reason, there is a reputation premium, so to speak, that's out there, where if you know the person that you're dealing with, then there is going to be a little bit more give. But being able to develop those relationships and work with people that you have good relationships with is going to help both sides make a little bit more fair offer and make this negotiation a lot smoother and a lot better for everyone involved. So I highly encourage that. And I will put a little plug in here that is really the motivation behind Advisor Advocates. The way I try to operate in our relationships is I don't try to build relationships with 150 or 200 firms all over the country. there are a few good firms out there that I know their reputation. I know who they are. I get to know them very, very well and actively look for all the ways that we can work together and help them grow and find the right partnerships. And they're flexible in the sense that they work with a lot of different types of advisors. And I know they're good folks. That doesn't mean that those are the only ones that I would consider. There's dozens of firms that do good things. And depending on the needs of the advisor, I'm always happy to conduct a search and go out and do my own due diligence. But I really do believe in getting to know the folks who we're working with and making sure that we're working with people that I know I can trust when I make a recommendation, who I know do good work and conduct fair deals with the advisors that they've worked with in the past. So I do put a high premium on that. Yes, it is a vested interest of mine in the sense that I am promoting how I operate the business a little bit there. But I do think it's an important one that really can't be ignored when you're going through this process. And if you are an advisor or a team or a firm who is interested in looking into what's out there and interested in seeing in real terms and not just, sort of generic bullet points that I tried to hit on in this show, I would love to have a conversation with you. Feel free to give me a call anytime on my cell phone number, which should be in the description below, 919-561-2436. We can chat, shoot me a text, let me know, and we can arrange a time to talk, listen to other episodes on the podcast. If there are any ways that I can help, feel free to schedule a call on my calendar, shoot me an email to garrett@theadvisoradvocates.com. And if I can help, would love to talk with you and better figure out what your firm is worth, and most importantly, connect with the right folks who may be interested in helping you get there. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great day.